calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. And sitting across from me, the senior senator from Nevada, Senator Harry Reid. Senator Reid, welcome.
Thank you, Tom.
So glad to have you with us. I was just showing you, Senator, before we went on the air, a hit piece that I just got from the RNC. And we get four or five of these things a day as being a talk show host. And also, once a year, I give $5 to the RNC just so I get all their junk. And it's amazing the flow of things that are coming out of the RNC. We also get the DNC stuff, and it's a trickle compared to this river. Do you see any kind of change coming in the way the DNC or the Democratic Party in general? In fact, I have to say, the best stuff I get is from your office, and it's the most of what I get.
The Republicans are the Karl Rove operation of America.
Yeah.
And the whole program is to distract, distort, and divide America. And hit pieces for me every day. They're after me every day. And I think one reason you don't see as much from the Democrats is, you know, we're pretty old-fashioned. We like to talk about issues and where we have better ideas than they have, but they don't. Theirs is always, I report the 3 Ds, distort, distract, and divide. That's what they're good at, and they've been pretty successful. I think the American people have caught on to them. Last week is a perfect example. We have these staggering gas prices. We have people can't send their kids to college. We have the war going on in Iraq. We have these deficits. And what do we talk about? All week, gay marriage and estate tax,
right,
which affects not many people in our country.
So the Democratic Party, for example, how about changing some of the frames? When Republicans go off on, for example, illegal immigration, why don't Democrats say, you know, if Tim Russert were interviewing you and he said, Senator Reid, about illegal immigration, why not simply come back and say, well, I believe that illegal employers is a problem in the United States, and literally reframe it just that fast in a couple of words?
Well, we have, I think, done a good job of framing the immigration debate. It's us that has talked about, first of all, security. Second, we have to have a guest worker program. Third, we have to bring people out of the shadows. And fourth, we really do have to do something to enforce employer sanctions, which have been a flop because last year, for example, Bush enforced three.
Yeah. But, I mean, isn't that the key? I mean, without illegal employers, we would not have illegal immigrants coming into this country if there wasn't jobs. So why not reframe this as an illegal employer problem?
Well, I think that we have tried to frame it in a way we think that the American people have identified with. And I think that long-term and short-term, it's good for the country and good for the party how we've done.
Yeah, well, good on you. The whole issue of gay marriage seems like a bigotry issue, really, to me. This reminds me of the debates in the 1950s about whether people of different races should be allowed to marry.
Well, Tom, to me, it's so unnecessary.
Mm.
It's a solution looking for a problem. This is a states' rights issue. Let the states handle this. This is just something that does not cause a problem to Americans because the states are handling it.
Yeah.
But the Republicans knew that it wouldn't get any votes. They were even surprised how few it got. 7 new Republicans in the Senate, same vote they got last time.
Yeah.
So it's they're and the American people no longer are concerned about this because, I repeat, the states are handling it.
Senator Harry Reid, just a few minutes ago on my local program on KPOJ in Portland, we had on an Iraq war vet, and he had been stationed with the Louisiana National Guard in Iraq. And I asked him, you know, what their mindset was. And he said they started out thinking that they'd gone over there looking for WMD. This was just a year ago.
Well, that's what all of us did, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, and he said within 9 months they figured out that there was no WMD. And I said, well, did they begin to question George W. Bush's leadership? And he said no. And I said, why? And he said, because they think of him as a strong leader. How can we communicate the fact that George Bush has not been a strong leader to this United States? In fact, he and his agenda are diminishing the power of the United States, but our internal strength and our external image.
I believe, first of all, that he's doing a pretty good job himself of minimizing his power and his strength.
Mm.
conversely, I spoke to a man who had had two tours of duty in Iraq, and he felt just the opposite. In fact, I talked to one man during the elections last November, 2004, I should say. He said where he was in Iraq, there was general depression when the election results came in. There was not joy and celebration that Bush had won.
Yeah, because they were hoping for a Kerry victory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Health care seems to be an issue. This is one of those areas. It amazes me. You do the surveys, and I believe it was a recent Pew study. There was a recent study that was published where they asked Americans, if it increased your taxes, would you be willing to pay extra taxes if it meant that everybody in the United States could have health care, a national health care system? And over 70%, as I recall, might have been 68%, it was in the neighborhood of 70% of Americans said yes. This is an issue in the middle. And yet, the media and the Republicans have succeeded in framing any attempt to reform our broken, privatized healthcare system as a liberal issue, as if it's some sort of small interest group. Isn't the real interest group, respectfully, Senator Frist's father and his family? I mean, they're the billionaires?
It's interesting. This healthcare issue hits everyone. Poor, middle class, and people doing business, trying to survive. This is an issue that affects everyone. But I think to show the hypocrisy of what the Republicans are doing, let's look at stem cell research.
Yes.
Stem cell research holds out hope for millions of people and their families suffering from Alzheimer's, Lou Gehrig disease, diabetes, Parkinson's, and on and on. We have tried for more than a year to get a day on the Senate floor to be able to debate stem cell research. No. They're gay marriage and estate tax. What is more important to the American people, health care, gay marriage, or estate tax?
Yeah, so literally because of the Republican control of the Senate, you have not been able to get one day to debate stem cell research?
Not a single hour. The Republicans control Washington. The constitutional form of government as we have known it is no longer here. We have, the founding fathers set up three branches of government. We only have two. During the Bush years, we have the judiciary and we have the executive. There is no legislative branch of government. He hasn't issued a single veto. Why? Because he gets anything he wants from the Republican Congress. We have no Congress. It's an executive branch. That's all we've got. Take, for example, during the Clinton years when the Republicans were in charge, one committee, Government Operations, issued 1,052 subpoenas to the Bush administration. They spent 140 hours requiring him to respond to his Christmas card list. How many subpoenas have we had for the Iraqi war?
That was the Clinton administration?
Yeah. How many subpoenas have we had issued now, the Bush administration, on the Iraq war? Zero. How many subpoenas have we had issued on the domestic spying? Zero.
Now, I've had Republicans on this program who have, and I raised this issue. You know, the Republicans control the House and Senate, and therefore they control the legislative agenda, and so nothing happens. And they say, well, it was the same when the Democrats controlled the House and Senate. That's not my recollection. And correct me if I'm wrong. You've been in the business for a long time.
First of all, when Clinton was president, you should remind our Republican friends, the last 3 years he was in office, we paid down the national debt by $500 billion. We were spending less money than we were taking in. That's really good news for America. We have a track record. We can do that. We established the COPS program, which really caused the crime rate to go down because we put more cops back on the beat. I think that the Republicans simply don't want to govern, because when you start talking about the things that are important to the American people, they're on the wrong side of those issues. They're on the wrong side of the energy issue. Exxon, $34 billion, the most money a company has ever made in the history of this country. Have we had any help with energy? No.
And part of the problem, of course, is if you can't govern if you don't believe in government.
Well, you can't govern
this
when the oil-happy administration ever had. Bush made his fortune in oil. Cheney made his fortune in oil. Condoleezza Rice, board of directors of Chevron. I mean, that says it all.
Yeah, and it answers so many very different things. Senator Harry Reid, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for allowing me to be on your show.
It's really great, and it's truly marvelous, the work that you're doing for America. I'm so grateful to you. Thank you. Thank you, sir. It's 15 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartmann radio program here on America. We're broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. We'll be back with you in just a minute.
Thank you.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
That's right, it's one of my favorite songs. Back home, home on the range. Oh, give me a home where no liberals roam and the folks all think the same way. Where each house has a gun, a big caliber one, and strangers are told, make my day. Home, home on the range, where the beer and the cantaloupe lay.
Indeed, welcome back. 21 minutes where past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Bob Borisage. Oop, let me pot up your mic here. There you go.
Okay.
Hey, Bob, the Campaign for America's Future. We talked a couple of days ago on my local show, as I recall. It's this is our national program. And Campaign for America's Future, the folks who are putting on this gig, the Take Back America Conference. Tell us about the conference.
Well, the conference is a gathering of over 2,000 progressive activists and leaders and intellectuals and organizers. And they come from across the country, and they are going to be going through a big agenda about what we are for, what the issue campaigns we're driving, what the new capacity that's getting built in the progressive community as we build a progressive movement that's ready to take back America.
Indeed. And how did OurFuture.org, how did the Campaign for America's Future come about?
We started about 200 people came together to set us up because they were deeply concerned about the conservative drift, the right-wing drift of our politics in both parties. And so we were set up to try to argue a very different kind of strategy for America in the world, and particularly at home on kitchen table issues and our economy, which was increasingly working for only a few and not for the many. And so we have made that our sort of signature set of issues.
We're talking with Bob Borisage, the director of the Campaign for America's Future, essentially the host of this whole gig here.
Yep.
That's Gladys Harry Reid and everybody else. Bob, the highlights of this conference, the things that people should know about the conference, people, speakers, events, workshops. It's more than just, hey, let's all get together
right.
And party.
Right. Well, the first two sessions, long sessions, are on our positive agenda. We will highlight Apollo, the alliance for a concerted drive for energy independence to create new jobs, invest in alternative energy and renewable energy, get our country off our dependence on foreign oil, and start to redress global warming. And I think that will be an enormously exciting initiative. I know it's an enormously popular initiative out in the country, and the only reason we haven't gotten to it is because of the grip of big oil on this administration and this city. We will be looking at and highlighting Medicare for All, the drive to create a health care plan that works for every American, that relieves companies of the burden on their, that makes them less competitive, that allows small businesses to contribute to a health care plan without it bankrupting them. That
how would we do Medicare for All? Just let everybody buy into it?
I think you can redesign a Medicare program that everybody contributes to, every business contributes to, and that creates a central pool that provides health care that people can choose their own doctor, but they have one insurer. And it in the money you save, you can cover the 45 million people that don't have health insurance now. That's a reality that has been confirmed by the Republican-run Congressional Budget Office and its studies about universal health care.
Now, just last month, front-page story in the Wall Street Journal that the CEO of the second-largest health insurance company in the United States just took a $1.6 billion salary. We're not talking, you know, pay and compensation, but for 1 year. We're not talking about, you know, the $400 million Lee Raymond retirement. This is $1.6 billion for a year. You don't think that that guy is going to take a few hundred million of that $1.6 billion that he made that year and say, you know, we're going to take these guys down the way we took down Bill and Hillary?
Oh, yes. The fight for this is not going to be easy. The fact that it's rational, that it makes all the good sense in the world, and that you can't solve any of our fiscal problems without dealing with it, much less make the country healthier, doesn't matter. There are deeply entrenched, you're talking about 16% of the GDP, there's deeply entrenched interests. People have very personal and institutional
so
profit.
So how do you
concerns.
Deal with that? I mean, the Clintons were not able to, I mean, and well, frankly, I mean, they weren't even offering Medicare for all. They had a program that arguably would have increased the profits of the health insurance companies, at least over the short term. But it would have whetted the appetite of Americans, I think, for single-payer health care, and that's what they were afraid of. If the president, if a sitting president is not capable of advancing, or is it that actually you're in a stronger position than Clinton was because he had the presidency?
Well, I think there's no way you do it without a citizen movement that is mobilized and is prepared to educate people and counter the unbelievable set of distortions that will take place. But the other thing that's happened is the world's changed. People have lived with the health care system we have. They are experiencing the out-of-control health care costs. They've seen the way that drug companies ripped off the prescription drug benefit and passed a law that prohibits Medicare, for God's sakes, from negotiating a better price for seniors. And so, in fact, the public is more aware of the interests that are arrayed against it. But that doesn't mean it's not going to be a hell of a Donnybrook to get there.
Mm.
But socially, you know, I think progressives have got to put out the big ideas that are vital to the country, and let's fight about it. Let's passionately support them, and let's take on the interests that get in the way of it.
I think that's one of the things that Americans want more than anything else is somebody who not only has the courage of their convictions, but is willing to put it forward to take names and kick butt and get out there and actually do things rather than just kind of milquetoast it through. Bob Borisaj, he's the director of the Campaign for America's Future, host of this entire gig here, the Take Back America conference, where we're broadcasting live. Bob, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Great having you on the program. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. at the Take Back America Conference. Welcome back to our program. First named Hurricane of the Year, and who do they name it after? Our Attorney General. It's Hurricane Alberto, indeed. I don't know if that was intended, but it just seems somehow appropriate. By the way, over the weekend, or on Friday, actually, Friday was the opening day of the movie An Inconvenient Truth, the Al Gore movie, in Portland, Oregon, which is, you know, where I live normally. And it was absolutely remarkable. It's a great movie. And I was just so impressed by this movie. It was incredible. Roger Ebert said that in his 29 years of doing movie reviews, he has never before written the words, "You owe it to yourself to watch this movie." But he said that. And I'm telling you, it is just amazing. And the attacks on global warming science. And now we've got George Will out there with his wimpy little thing. He's at it again. As they note over at the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org, the blog, George Will, when Gore says the scientific debate is over, he merely meant that there's a consensus that we're in a period of warming. Yeah. Sorry. Is that for right now? For this second? Yeah, sure. This is live radio, my friends. We're broadcasting live from the Take Back America conference. And from time to time, the folks who are putting the conference on are going to be feeding us guests, as it were, not entirely. Oh, this we you are da, da, da. Yeah, Ezra Klein is scheduled, but he didn't show up. Okay, Great. Joanne Derwin, welcome. Have a seat. Pull up a microphone. Pull up a headphones. There we go. The wonders of live radio. We are on the air live as we speak. And Joanne Derwin is the director of Urban Agenda, the website urbanagenda.org. Joanne, welcome.
Thank you.
What brought you here to the Take Back America conference, other than a plane, train, or automobile?
Well, I'm part of the National Apollo Alliance Network, and one of our key initiatives is called New York City Apollo, mm-hmm. where we facilitate connections amongst disparate stakeholders. We work with labor unions, progressive businesses, environmental justice advocates that have come together to really transform the way New York City is powered.
Yeah.
We're based in New York City. We're looking at the linkage between job creation and energy independence.
You know, it's amazing. I was just talking about George Will's column. And George Will recycles this old bromide, this, I'd say, tired old bromide, that you have to make a choice between the environment and the economy. And if the environment gets better, the economy gets worse. In fact, it's a lie.
It is. It's, in fact, absolutely not the case. And what we're trying to prove is that through energy efficiency policies, through what we call high-performance construction, when we work to integrate sustainable practice into architecture, we can, in fact, build new jobs for New York City and promote and look at sustainability as an economic engine instead of...
It's really sort of the argument that typewriter manufacturers were making 15 years ago. I don't think anyone actually came out and said it, but could have made, you know. You know, you have your choice between the strong, vibrant economy with 25 typewriter manufacturers across the United States employing thousands of people, or else we can go to these stupid computer things.
Right.
And it's going to destroy the economy, don't you know?
Well,
why doesn't the average American get it that alternative energy is the equivalent of the dot-com boom? I mean, it's just sitting there waiting to happen.
I think people are getting it. And, in fact, we just had a plenary here at Take Back America about the polling data. And I think what we lack is not technology, but what we lack is political will. And
but what does that mean? Do you mean that we lack leaders who are willing to speak out? Because I think the vast majority of Americans have the political will to make this happen.
Well, exactly. I feel like we lack political leadership to make this happen. And that's changing New York City, but it's not changing fast enough. And so, which is why we believe that building this coalition, that's unheard of coalition, of all these different people coming together with disparate agendas to try to develop a shared agenda and then advocate with a unified voice is what's so critical to this change.
Right. Joanne Derwin is with Urban Agenda, urbanagenda.org. Are you physically doing anything in New York, or is this entirely a political project? In other words, we know that you're pulling together all these organizations, but have you taken a roof and solarized it?
We haven't, but our partners have. We get to work with, for example, the electrical workers, the IBEW Local 3 in New York City.
International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Yes, thank you. Excuse me, all the acronyms.
My brother's a member of it, so it's easy to remember.
Okay. So Local 3 and other electrical workers unions around the state are doing some incredible work partnering with Sierra Club, where the electrical workers are installing solar panels for Sierra Club members and in their own homes to demonstrate that this is possible. It's also a training opportunity to retool a workforce so that there's other job opportunities for this type of worker. Similarly, we work with amazing groups like the New York Industrial Retention Network, which is working with local manufacturers, getting manufacturers to realize that there's an opportunity in this new market in green building products. We look at, you have a window manufacturer, and to transform their process from building traditional windows to energy-efficient windows isn't tremendously challenging.
Yeah.
But it still takes time. And when you're a manufacturer in New York City, you're up against great odds.
Yeah.
And to take the chance to transform your product to be green is something that you need help with. And so working with groups like that that are making this happen throughout the five boroughs is really what we try to do. We're not doing the projects on the ground, but we're rather trying to connect people, amplify their stories, work with elected officials, make sure this work becomes part of public discourse and public debate.
It seems, Joanne Derwin, that in New York City or in any urban area, highly densely populated urban area, that the focus when you're talking about alternative energies would be different than a suburban, exurban, or rural area, in as much as there's not as much physical space. For example, in a lightly populated area, you would think that probably the population of farm communities, for example, if they just threw up enough windmills or enough solar panels, they could generate 100% of their own electricity. In Germany now, about a third of the homes now have solar panels on their roofs because of an aggressive program the German government put together with the banks and the power companies. Everybody's paying for it. Nobody's paying for it. Ultimately, it pays for itself. That sort of thing could be done in the exurbs, in the suburbs of the United States. But in Manhattan, it seems like the focus would instead of being on generation of power, have to be on conservation of power, wouldn't? Or is there a generation technology that adapts itself well to urban areas that I'm missing somehow?
Well, of course there is, and in fact, in New York City has to be a dual strategy, both in terms of energy efficiency and conservation, mm-hmm. but also in terms of generation. So in terms of the efficiency piece, there's so much we can do to make our buildings more efficient in New York City. And the New York State Energy Research and Development Agency has some really incredible programs that they're pioneering and piloting in New York City to do things like, you know, everything from changing light bulbs to make them more energy efficient, to have energy auditors come in and do an analysis of a building to look at ways that a building could become more energy efficient. Mm-hmm. There's also certainly ways of conservation. But in terms of power, you know, you certainly have a possibility of doing things like solar panels. There's, you know, miles and miles of rooftop in New York City. And you're imagine right. if we put solar panels on a great number of those. Think, in fact, if we only put solar panels on schools. Schools alone would be an ideal teaching opportunity and would really create a new opportunity to generate energy. And if we could find a way to use those energy savings to invest into education, that too would be really remarkable.
Oh, sure.
And there's also, you know, energy technologies that are being piloted in New York City that aren't used elsewhere. So there's this new energy technology that looks at harnessing the tidal power of the rivers that surround New York City.
Interesting.
So there's so much that's, again, we don't like the technology. What we lack is this a push to make it all happen.
Yeah. In fact, my best friend lives in Manhattan and has all his life. And the building that he lives in was built by the garment workers as a co-op for the union members
right.
back in the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s.
What is?
Yeah, it's on 8th Avenue, mm-hmm. between 28th and 29th. And that building, about 10 years ago, they took it off the grid, essentially. They put in their own electrical generation plant. It uses oil as the kind of backup. But you go downstairs on your way out, you know, if you're going out the back door, and there's this giant bin where everybody throws their newspapers and anything that's combustible. And they are burning their own trash to generate their own electricity in that building. And they've been doing this for 10 years, I think, at least. I mean, you know, it's just like there's so much trash generated in Manhattan. If each building burned it, now they figured out a way to scrub it so it's not polluting the air around
it. Right, that's
it.
Critical. You wouldn't want to
yeah.
add to...
Right, but the technology is there. I mean, this is not rocket science. So
right.
It's absolutely remarkable. Joanne Derwin, the Urban Agenda is the website. Joanne, what can individuals do to support what you're doing? In just a few words.
Well, I would really encourage people to go on the website, learn more about the work we're doing. There's lots of opportunities to get involved, some of which is outlined on the website. There's volunteer opportunities. We would encourage you to sign on to our 10-point plan, which we call a 10-point plan for the 21st century. We need to keep New York City the preeminent global city, and to do that, we need to address energy planning more equitably in a more far-sighted manner.
Well said. Joanne Derwin, she's the director of Urban Agenda, urbanagenda.org, the website, what they're doing in Manhattan. Maybe you could do it in a town near you. You're encouraging other groups to pick up what you're doing.
Please, definitely. Look at our website and also check out the ApolloAlliance.org, which
Great.
Is the national network.
Thank you. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tuesday in November, I took that stroll to cast my ballot at the local poll. The lines were long, but I didn't care. I had water, a hat, and my folding chair. Walked up to the booth, didn't say a word. Sure, that's
my voice would be heard. I hit that button, my vote was sent. But now nobody knows exactly where it went. I lost my vote. It isn't fair. I took a stand. Doesn't anybody care? It
happened to a lot of people here. They lost our votes. Oh, man. The big question now in the Busby race, why did the Libertarian candidate get so many more votes in that particular congressional district than anywhere else in the state? I mean, it's like hundreds of percent greater, but we digress. Robert Biko Baker is with us here. Biko is a nationally recognized hip-hop political strategist. He served as the deputy political coordinator and young voter organizer for the Brown and Black presidential forum televised in January. He's also a frequent contributor to The Source, a national magazine that focuses on hip-hop music, culture, and politics. A couple of websites for you, hiphoparchive.org and 2006 hiphopconvention.org, which is happening July 21st through the 24th in Chicago. So, Biko, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. I think a lot of folks don't think of hip-hop and politics in the same breath, thought, whatever.
That's right.
What's going on?
Man, there's a great movement going on. Since the 2004 convention, some of the greatest non-traditional strategies have been developed by the National Hip Hop Political Convention folks. Individuals like Malia Laza, who works for Progressive Majority, myself, who works for the League of Young Voters, Kari Mosley, who works for the League of Independent Voters. These individuals who use hip-hop culture and really mobilize people in inner-city communities to get involved politically.
How?
It's tough. In 2004, I worked for the Young Voter Alliance, and we mobilized 14,000 people in the inner city communities. And we did it strictly by going to the block and talking to people, straight talk, honest talk. We used art and culture to really, you know, our literature looked different than traditional Dem literature, but we went to the block and gave people real talk. We always use the catchphrase in hip-hop, that keeping it real. And we went to the block and talked about the issues that they're most passionate about.
So this is really just a subcultural variation on the old-fashioned shoe leather thing of doing politics is knocking on doors and putting
right.
step after step.
That's the only way you're going to be able to reach the hip-hop community, specifically because we're skeptical. We're militantly skeptical, as author Jeff Chang likes to talk about, because we've been lied to a lot. And, you know, we're media savvy. We can turn on the TV and see which candidate is lying or not. We can listen to the talking points and say, oh, that's a talking point.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be up to the hip-hop generation, which includes all races and genders and ethnicities, to keep the progressive movement pushing forward.
Now, Biko Baker, we probably have some listeners who don't even, you know, you say hip-hop and it's like, huh?
Yeah.
Give us a 30-second crash course here.
Hip-hop is a rebellion, a culture of rebellion that came out of the South Bronx in the 1970s. So people come up using breakdancing, rap music, DJing, and dance, graffiti art, to really express themselves and define themselves as a human being. So that's, we have a 30-year movement going on right now.
Is it largely a movement in the African-American community, or is it extended into other...
Yeah. I went to Portland, Maine a month ago, and I was invited by the League of Young Voters, and the thing that they said to me was it's a hip-hop event. Now, I know Maine is 95% white, and I went there. It was a mostly white crowd, but they had breakdancers, they had graffiti art, they had rapping, and they used that event to really have a candidate forum with the people that are running for governor in Maine. So hip-hop has reached the whole globe. It's everywhere.
Yeah, and that's the cool thing about it. Unlike some of the movements, like, for example, the civil rights movement of the 60s, there were a lot of white folks involved
That's
in that,
right.
But they were basically there as, like, we're here to help.
Yeah.
Not like, you know, this is our battle. I mean,
yeah.
Well, there was a sense of it, but this is something that it's a change. This is not a racial thing. It's a cultural thing.
That's
I guess
right.
is the bottom line is what I'm trying to say.
We encourage everybody to get down with hip hop.
Yeah. So tell me about this convention you're going to have in July, the 21st through the 23rd.
Yeah, we had the first convention in 2004. We had 3,000 people show up. Like I said before, some of the greatest non-traditional strategies have come out of that. So we're going to push it in 2006. July 21st to the 24th, you can meet Zach Exley from MoveOn.org, who's actually going to be able to do a training. Malia Lazu from Progressive Majority. We're going to have Afrika Bambaataa and some of the greatest hip-hop names and elders. So it's going to be a great event, but we're really focusing on training so that we can have a push into the 2008 election.
And what are y'all doing here at the Take Back America Conference?
I was actually on the plenary session, just got done talking with Stan Greenberg and Katrina from the Nation, and I'm going to be on the Emerging Leaders Conference. So we're just talking about how young people, particularly people of color, can get involved and really help us take back America.
And step by step, getting candidates out there, getting issues out there. What do you think are the major issues that are perceived, or what are perceived as major issues by people in the hip-hop community?
I think the key thing is the same issues that go on in the rest of the community. We want cheaper health care. We don't want to go to the emergency room and have to give up a whole week's worth of pay. We don't want to have to pay $3 for gas. And we want our streets to be safe. So the very same things that progressives, mainstream progressives talk about, the hip-hop progressives talk about too.
Yeah, it's just a fairly straightforward process. I heard a funny noise there. I thought for a minute we dropped our connection to New York. No, we're still connected to New York because there's Alex yelling at us.
Okay.
Yeah. So any specific hip-hop solutions coming out, you know?
The main thing is just using the culture to talk to people. So in Milwaukee, we use spoken word, we use art, we use dancing, we use rap music to go talk to people.
What about parties?
We use parties. We go to, that's our main...
political parties, like the Republicans and Democrats. Any, you know, taking back the Democratic Party, infiltrating the Republican Party, things like that?
Kahari Mosley, who's one of our lead organizers, is actually Democratic Ward Chairman in Pittsburgh. So we're going to take over the Democratic Party, too.
Cool. That's
all
great.
Right.
Okay. Biko Baker is with us. And Biko, thanks for being with us. The nationally recognized hip-hop political strategist, deputy publicity coordinator, young voter organizer for the Brown and Black Presidential Forum, Tallahassee in January. The websites, and check this thing out, 2006 hiphopconvention.org, that's for the convention, and hiphoparchive.org. Biko, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great having you on the program. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back with more live from the Take Back America Conference, broadcasting live here from Washington, D.C.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. Jim Schoenbeck and Mark Birnbaum are with us. They are the producers, directors, writers,
editors
of a new documentary.
We did it all.
You did it all. And this is going to be released independently. It's going to be on public television and the Discovery Channel. Is that true?
I don't know. That's news to us.
No, we don't have any broadcast set up yet.
Available online at TomDelayMovie.com.
I see, but other work you guys have done has been on
exactly,
PBS.
Yeah.
PBS. Our last film was on the POV series on PBS.
Right, so this is the Tom Delay Movie, TomDelayMovie.com. And the name of the movie is?
The Big Buy, Tom Delay's Stolen Congress.
And why Tom Delay and the Stolen Congress? Why is that worth making a movie out of?
The level of corruption that Tom Delay brought to Congress is unprecedented, and the way that he brought it about is unprecedented through redistricting in Texas.
For example?
Well, he's, of course, one of the major architects, along with several other people, of the K Street Project that integrated corporatism into Congress, and basically... you had to pay to play in Congress. It was all determined about how much you gave to the Republican Party or to Tom Delay in order to get what Ronnie Earl calls FaceTime with Delay or any of the Republican leaders, and an amalgamation of corporatism and state, the power of the state. And he did that in a way that nobody else had up to that point. And what our film is a kind of connect-the-dots story about why he's in trouble in Texas, first of all, how he got in trouble in Texas, and why it's not just a Texas problem, how it affects the rest of the country and Congress in general.
Jim mentioned Ronnie Earl. Ronnie Earl is the district attorney in Travis County, Texas. That's where Austin is. And he happens, because he's in Austin as a DA, his jurisdiction covers any crimes that happen at the state capitol. So over the years, he has prosecuted various Republicans and Democrats who have committed crimes as state legislators or as governor. And that's where it is alleged that Tom Delay committed the crime of spending corporate money on Texas elections in 2002. It's been a felony since 1905 in Texas to do that, to spend labor money or corporate money.
Now, what this is all about really is redistricting, isn't it? I mean, this is
part of it. It's really about the Republicans' idea of creating a permanent majority of GOP members in Congress, one that would hold up for 20 or more years.
Even if the majority of America became Democratic.
Absolutely. They would gerrymander districts, not only Texas, but they wanted to export this to Georgia, to Pennsylvania, to Colorado, and everywhere.
And they have successfully done so in all those states, have they not?
They have tried. I'm not sure I don't think they've been as successful as they have in Texas in bringing, for instance, five new Congress people to D.C. as a result of that. But they certainly want to do that, and that was part of the master plan that Tom DeLay laid out and is very blunt about explaining to people. He's very proud of this fact. It's not a secret that he had this plan. He's very open about it.
Yeah. So the Constitution says that every year that ends with zero, every 10 years, a census will be held, and based on that census, the number of congressional districts will be determined, and the size of those congressional, or the size of the congressional districts, the lines of the congressional districts,
so that everybody gets about the same, every representative gets about the same number of people to represent,
right? So
more or less,
so that we have more or less equal representation,
right,
in Congress. It wasn't the Republican Party that invented the idea of gerrymandering.
No, it's gone around. Everybody's taking a good whack at it.
And, in fact, this is the point that the Republicans make when people complain about Tom DeLay, is they say, Democrats have been doing this forever.
Absolutely, but not to the extent that Mr. DeLay did. He brought it to a whole new level.
Are we talking about Democrats took it to 30% and he took it to 40%, or Democrats?
No, part of it is as a result, this time around at least, of having computers available to do this so that you can actually almost redistrict block by block. And do it in a way.
City block by city block.
Yes, absolutely. And do it in such a way that not only gives you five more incumbents, but strips Democrats of the ability, for instance, to attract Anglo votes, because you ghettoized them, so to speak, in black and Hispanic districts. And it's just an incredible reach of technology and DeLay's ambition that combined to make this redistricting issue a problem in Texas and gave him basically five new Tom DeLay clones that he sent to D.C. from Texas as a result. And it has an impact on national policy. The energy bill, budget bills, CAFTA, the free trade agreement with Central America, all were passed by less than five votes, and those are the five votes that Tom DeLay picked up in Texas.
So you could argue, and I think you just did, Jay Schoenbeck, that, and Mark Birnbaum is with us as well, the guys who come up with this new movie, TomDeLayMovie.com, the website, that the name of the movie, again,
The Big Buy, Tom DeLay's Stolen Congress.
Thank you, Mark. You could argue that CAFTA, which is going to wipe out, you know, probably millions of American jobs and add to the impoverishment of Central America as well, consolidate the power of the oligarchs in Central America and consolidate the power of the oligarchs in the United States, the corporate power. You could argue that this massive trade bill worth billions of dollars, probably ultimately perhaps trillions, hundreds of billions certainly, to trillions of dollars, thousands of billions of dollars, that this all came down to Tom DeLay getting a few hundred thousand dollars from a couple of big corporations in Texas and committing a felony, or at least what Ronnie Earl asserts is a felony, in giving that money to local Texas politicians to get local Republican control of the local, meaning statewide, of the state of Texas legislature, so that he could then use that political majority in Texas to redistrict Texas in such a way that he could establish a national majority.
He actually did redistrict Texas, because the redistricting had already been completed and approved by the courts.
This is the classic, you know, for want of the leader, the battle was lost. For want of the horse,
right,
the leader was lost.
No, it's like a row of dominoes.
Yeah.
And you start out in Texas, and by the time you're finished, you're affecting policy not only nationally but internationally, as you just pointed out with CAFTA. The energy bill, all a result of five votes or less. A lot of these budget resolutions that have cut food and housing programs for folks, those are being passed with less than five votes. Tom DeLay was having trouble attracting moderate Republicans, and he needed to get rid of those Republicans and replace them with what people call DeLay Republicans. And that's what this plan was all about.
And that's what he did.
Yes.
So,
and very successfully, with one exception, that he used corporate money to fund these local, statewide elections in 2002.
Which was against the law.
It is against the law.
In Texas.
In Texas.
In Texas and 17 other states. A civil court, in a civil lawsuit filed by some of the legislators who lost their seats as a result of this, found the Texans for a Republican Majority and the Texas Association of Business guilty of violating that law and fined them. So in a civil trial, they've already been found guilty.
Although the civil and criminal thresholds, civil requires
right.
a preponderance of the evidence,
that's
criminal
right.
requires beyond
a
reasonable doubt.
This case was in front of a judge that the TRMPAC people selected. They thought they were going to get a great ruling out of this guy. He's a
TRMPAC
Republican.
TRMPAC is Texans for Republican Majority, Tom DeLay's PAC.
Right.
So it was a surprise to them.
Right. So, first of all, what does this mean for the future of democracy in America? Tom DeLay has stacked the deck to the extent that even if the majority of Americans are voting Democratic in the congressional races, you're not going to have a majority of Democrats in Congress, number one. And number two, if he is found guilty, if he's convicted of a felony for setting this thing up, would that cause any of it to be undone, what he's done? Or does
no.
he just merrily laugh all the way to the no. to the penitentiary?
I guess the one thing that could cause some of it possibly to be undone is the fact that that map that DeLay created is being heard by the case. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court that will be heard this month. The voting rights section of the Department of Justice issued a memo. How long ago was that?
In 2003.
2003,
right after
this. Saying that they felt the map was illegal, that the map violated the Voting Rights Act. The Department of Justice quashed that report, and that now that it was leaked out, it's in a case at the Supreme Court, and they're going to look at that map and decide whether it was legal or not, and whether it violates the Voting Rights Act. I guess it's conceivable that those lines could be drawn again.
Yeah, they could do any number of things. They could throw out the whole map. They could redraw a couple of districts that are most egregiously drawn against minorities, or they could leave it the way it is.
None of this would come directly out of a trial of Tom DeLay, though. But
no,
some of it could come as a result of a conviction. Couldn't it come in the absence of a conviction?
Yes.
It's not dependent on the conviction.
They're on independent tracks.
Okay,
right.
Mark Birnbaum, Jim Schermbeck. The producers of the new movie,
The Big Five, Tom DeLay Stolen Congress.
And the website, TomDeLayMovie.com. Check it out. And it's opening in theaters all across the country in the weeks to come, as they say. Right?
And available on DVD right now.
At
cool.
the website.
Okay, Mark and Jim, thanks for being with us.
You're
much
welcome.
Much appreciated. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Whatever's wrong with this cruel world of Clinton is to blame. Oh, is Bill Clinton's fault? Is Bill Clinton's fault? That's murder or assault. Bill Clinton is to blame. Oh.
Yes, indeed. It's the official Republican mantra. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Jeff Faux is with us, pronounced Faux, right?
That's right.
F-A-U-X.
That's right.
Jeff Faux, he's the founding president and distinguished fellow with the Economic Policy Institute, EPI.org, the website. And Jeff, you have a new book out.
That's right. It's called The Global Class War.
And what is the global class war?
Well, it's a look at globalization from the point of view of people who work for a living, which is the vast majority of Americans and the vast majority of people in every country. What I've analyzed is how the globalization is creating a new class system that crosses borders. At the top, there's what I call the Party of Davos. These are the multinational corporations and the politicians and the people in the media who carry their water. It's not a surprise that the global economy should be creating a global class system. I mean, every market economy, every society has a class system. But for 50 years in this country, we had a social contract among the classes, so that enough trickled down to keep everybody reasonably improving.
Well, and in fact, wasn't there... By the way, I should just let our listeners know I didn't mention it when we came back from the break. We're broadcasting live from the Take Back America conference, so if you hear a lot of noise in the background, that's what's going on.
Yeah, a lot of people here,
with thousands of other people.
Yeah.
Wasn't a dimension of that social contract that people of wealth got it, that it was actually in their interest that there be a middle class in America?
Absolutely. Actually, it was Henry Ford at the turn of the last century who... when he started to pay his workers $5 a day, which was big money back in 1912.
It was about 2.5 times what Dodd was paying.
And so the other industrialists got on Henry, and Henry said, well, wait a minute, these are the people who are making the cars, and they're buying the cars. Later on in the 1950s, Charlie Wilson, who was Dwight Eisenhower's Secretary of Defense, said what's good for General Motors is good for America. And a lot of liberals sneered at it, but... The UAW and most people understood that was right. But over the last 20, 25 years, things have changed dramatically. If corporations can get their workers in other countries, if they can get their financing in other countries, and if increasingly they see that their consumers are going to be in other countries, then the connection between American workers and the American big investors, the corporate investors, is broken. And that's what's happened. And I use the trade agreements, especially the North American Free Trade Agreement, as an example of how the class system works. Jorge Castaneda, who later became Foreign Minister of Mexico, said that NAFTA was an agreement between the rich and powerful of all three countries, leaving ordinary people out. And so it's no surprise that the ordinary people of all three countries have paid the costs and the people at the top the benefits. You see that in the immigration issue. We've been debating that now for the last several months. And there's an 800-pound gorilla on the table that nobody's talking about, and that is Mexico. Immigration involves two points in geography, where you're going to and where you're coming from. And one of the things I analyze in the book is how NAFTA not only did not deliver the decrease in illegal immigration that was promised by Bill Clinton and Carlos Salinas and the people at the top, but by opening up Mexico's economy to subsidize American corn and wheat, it blew away several million farmers from Mexico's rural landscape. They had no place to go, no jobs, so it's no surprise that illegal immigration to the United States more than doubled since NAFTA.
Yeah.
That's off the table because people in Washington and people in Mexico City have their fingerprints on this.
Yeah. Now, we're talking with Jeff Foh with the Economic Policy Institute and his new book titled...
The Global Class War.
And we're talking about the Global Class War. We have just about 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes here left, and just the breakdown of the social contract, some would suggest that the reason why the social contract is broken down is because managers no longer live in the communities with their workers, and that a large part of that is because Reagan essentially stopped enforcing the Sherman Act, and we had all these mega mergers and consolidations. Is that a piece of this?
Yes, I think it's a piece of it, but it's a mistake to think that all of this is just about the Republicans. There are Democratic fingerprints on this, too, and I think the lesson of the book and the lesson of our recent history is that progressives have to be tougher. They have to and not be taken in by people who claim to be progressive but essentially vote for and are carrying the water for Wall Street.
Yeah, or if they don't, sometimes they don't even claim to be progressive. They just say, you know, I'm your Democratic
candidate. That's right. You know, the lesson of my book is that's not enough.
The book, The Global Class War. We're seeing a global class war. We're seeing an American class war. Very briefly, what's the solution?
Well, the first solution is obviously to get rid of these people who are running the show now. The second...
So that's a political solution.
It's a political... Well, it's all politics. Yeah. You know, the global economy is not about economics so much as it is about who gets what. It's about politics. The second thing we have to revisit things like NAFTA.
Yeah.
It didn't work for working people on both sides. We need a new vision of what North America could be like in the future.
So we need to bust it all up. We're talking with Jeff Foh. Jeff, thanks for being with us. EPI.org, his website, his book, The Global Class War. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You know it's me when I come through your town. I'm gonna ride around in style, I'm gonna drive everybody wild, cause I'll have the only one there is around.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Jay Harris is here with us with Mother Jones Magazine. Hey, Jay, welcome. Oh, let me turn your pod up here.
Okay. All right.
There we go. Now you can hear me, I can hear you, and everything is good.
Thanks for having me on.
So glad to have you here, Jay. Jay, tell us. I'm sorry, I don't have the. You've swapped out with somebody else who was.
Oh yes, yeah. you
so,
want my.
And so I don't have the page.
My pithy and interesting bio. I'm the publisher of Mother Jones Magazine.
Okay.
That's what you need.
Well, that's a great start. Yeah. And we're here broadcasting live from Washington D.C. the Take Back America conference, and Mother Jones Magazine. Mother Jones, of course. Well, actually, start with Mother Jones.
Mother Jones, the lady, is a woman who gets far too little attention in the history books. This is
really?
This is a woman who, in the late 1800s, started living out of a suitcase, going on the road, working with miners, working with kids working in the mills, and basically created the early labor, helped to create the early labor movement in this country.
Yeah.
She organized a march of the mill children across New Jersey to Teddy Roosevelt's home on Long Island when he was president, led to the first laws against child labor in this country.
Mm-hmm.
She was a hellraiser. She fired people up, and the Mother Jones Magazine, which was started 30 years ago, took its name from her.
Yeah, and in her efforts against, for example, child labor, she was really serving two constituencies. One was the children themselves. These kids should be in school. But the second was labor, because if you reduce the supply of labor, you increase the price of labor, which allows a middle class to emerge. And so Mother Jones Magazine, what are you doing here at the Take Back America Conference?
Mother Jones has been around the Take Back America Conference since its entire 4-year lifespan. We really believe in what these guys are doing. They bring folks from the political establishment, from the think tanks, from the grassroots, and from independent media together, really to think about, you know, how we can work together to create a progressive majority in this country.
So how do we do that? Jay Harris, publisher of Mother Jones Magazine.
Well, this will probably not surprise you, but I think a lot can be done by strengthening independent media. We have right now, and I run against this all the time, maybe you have the same experience, but even good progressive folks in the middle of Washington, D.C. often don't recognize the strength of what independent progressive media has done in reaching the grassroots. Last year, Mother Jones helped start a loose coalition called the Media Consortium. It's the biggest names in independent media, like Air America Radio and The Nation and Mother Jones and Salon.com and Link TV and Free Speech TV. And we're reaching on every day and every week in this country millions of folks, a lot of them not in New York and Washington.
And yet on the other side, there's real blowback happening. I mean, I know of three cities right now where there are organized campaigns, primarily within the business community, funded and directed by extreme right-wingers. They're quite upfront about it. I mean, they talk about it in letters to the editor of the newspapers and things, to buy Air America radio stations and flip them, take Air America off. And at least one of these campaigns has been at least partially successful. And it's like, where is our side on that? I mean, we tend not to represent the interests of big business. And to the extent that labor is on our side, labor has been largely marginalized since Ronald Reagan in 1981 officially declared war on organized labor in the United States, busting the PATCO strike and henceforth, you know, forevermore, world without end, amen. I mean, we're down to, what, 7-8% of the private workforce in the United States being unionized, whereas it was 35% at its high in 1947 when Taft-Hartley got passed. And which is another thing that needs to be handled, but that's, you know, let me not digress. How do we do this? I mean, it can't all be just sitting around waiting for George Soros to write a check.
No. I do think that the sophistication of progressive funders, and I mean for-profit money as well as non-profit
sure.
money.
And there's some very good ones, by the way. I mean, there's some good investors in Air America Radio, for example,
right.
the network that syndicates this program, and other ventures who are successful business people and progressives. It's okay, you know, they're not mutually exclusive, but I think we have to acknowledge that that's also the minority in the business community.
Right.
Progressives in the business community are a minority.
Well, Rupert Murdoch spent $435 million launching Fox News Network before he made a single dime.
Right, lost money for 5 years.
Washington
Times is still losing money,
right.
isn't it?
Right. So there's an investment in conservative media that is not even remotely touched by a parallel investment on the progressive side of things. And I think people have to sort of... I think the broadband offers some opportunities that might be less costly, but I think we have to just face up to the fact that we need some systematic investment in these areas to bring it to scale.
So how do we encourage that investment? How do we find those potential investors? How do we make it safe for them to invest? And actually, I'd like to even take it a step beyond that. How do we bring in the grassroots? I mean, Howard Dean demonstrated that you can do this with politics in the United States. What's wrong with doing it with media?
I think in some ways the most natural communities out there are folks who aggregate around their favorite media entities. Look at what happened with Robert Greenwald's Walmart film.
Yeah.
I mean, that was really an amazing story, completely done outside the traditional movie distribution channels.
Well, another example, not quite, you know, not with the fine political point, but another example is public broadcast.
Right.
You know, look at 35 million people listening to NPR, I mean, and supporting stations, and yet now the latest we hear from Washington D.C. just in the last week that they want to cut the Corporation for Public Broadcasting from, and you know, and they're trying to turn it into National Republican Radio, and you know, maybe to some extent they have.
Yeah.
I mean, lest we get off on that. But the point is that. We need to, progressives, we need to, it's the club lady recital, right? We all need to save us from it.
Yeah.
But
we could egg each other on, and it could get really tedious.
Yeah, I know. How do we initiate that process? How do you even say it? I know somebody, you know, Carolyn Kay runs a website, makethemaccountable.com, and... you know, has been just banging her head against the wall trying to get funding for this kind of thing. I mean, what's the most appropriate way for progressives to get out there and to raise money and to make things happen, make things work?
Well, at the risk of being kind of monotone here, I think there's a lot to be found in the models of the blogosphere.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
sort of grassroots ground up.
It's very grassroots. I mean, people have criticized the blogosphere for being white, for being the province of folks who have the broadband access and so forth. But I think what they've done is they've really engendered a truly democratic conversation where somebody does a bit of investigative reporting, they assert one thing, and you know, within sometimes, certainly hours and sometimes minutes, there's
Dan Rather discovered.
Yeah. That people are kind of checking that and kind of keeping it honest. I think there's the biggest problem I think we suffer from, we progressives and we the country suffer from right now is disengagement from politics. If folks can prove through low-cost internet-based media that they can build an audience of folks who are interested in real information, I think that could be, and get them re-engaged in politics in a non-cynical way, I think that could be enormously powerful. Now, how do you do that? I'm kind of the market mechanism. I think let's let a thousand flowers bloom and see, you know, who's smart about aggregating audiences. I think we've got the commercial press have so abdicated on their news delivery function, on getting the public the information they need to make smart decisions in their lives, that there's a big opportunity for those of us who are committed to substance.
I agree with you. We're talking with Jay Harris. He's the publisher of Mother Jones Magazine. We're broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference here in Washington, D.C. Jay, what's the biggest story in Mother Jones right now, current issue of Mother Jones?
The brand new issue of Mother Jones, which probably hasn't even reached newsstands yet. We have some copies here literally right off the press. There's a great piece on it on 3 days of secret meetings in Rome between representatives of the Pentagon, a shadowy American who was associated with Iran-Contra, and an Iranian exile, and otherwise known as a con man named Manooger Gurbanifar.
Oh, Gurbanifar from BCCI.
Yeah, exactly. Gurbanifar is back. And he is meeting with representatives of the government to talk about how they might plot an overthrow of the Iranian
government.
He was
involved in the October surprise in 1980. He was involved.
Some of the same characters. So it's deja vu.
This is the Iran equivalent of the
Ahmed Chalabi.
I was just going to say a Chalabi meeting with the guys from the Center, Project for New American Century.
Yeah.
So they're getting their ducks in a row. Do you see war in Iran as inevitable?
I don't see war in Iran as inevitable, but if we let ourselves be fooled again by the lie factory in this administration, then we may have it.
They're certainly cranking it up.
They're cranking up the volume.
Yeah, full tilt boogie. What else is in Mother Jones this issue?
We have the outsourcing of air safety inspections to private contractors under the supervision of the airlines themselves.
In other countries?
In America.
Oh, in America.
Yeah, the Federal Aviation.
I know a lot of them are going offshore.
Yeah. Well, there's an offshoring of the component, but they're also doing private contractors here, which report into the airlines.
Jay Harris, Mother Jones Magazine. The website is
MotherJones.com.
As you may expect. Thanks, Jay, for being with us.
Great. Good to be here.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We're broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. from the Take Back America Conference. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
What? A Republican House, a Republican Senate, a Republican President, a Republican Supreme Court? I don't think that's how life was meant to be. Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Congresswoman Barbara Lee is with us. She represents the 9th Congressional District of California. Congresswoman Lee.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you here. Great to have you here. You are one of the consistent, clearer voices in the House of Representatives on so many issues. I know the issue of Iraq and permanent bases in Iraq is a big one for you right now.
First, let me say thank you again for Air America, really, and making sure that all of us, especially in the Progressive Caucus, which I co-chair with Lynn Woolsey, have an opportunity to talk to the American people, because the news, quite frankly, is blacked out in many communities. What we have been working on, and I've been working on this for a couple of years, is a policy of the United States of America that just says, basically, we do not intend to build permanent military bases in Iraq. Over 75% of the American public believes that we should not be there on a permanent basis, and a large percentage, over 80% of the Iraqis, believe that we should not be there permanently. And in fact, Bush and Rumsfeld and all of them have said in a variety of forums that we don't intend to be there. Will not be a permanent occupation. So I decided to introduce a resolution a couple of years ago to codify that into law. We were able to bring forth the supplemental and put that amendment onto the supplemental, which, of course, passed by a voice vote. Republicans supported it. Democrats supported it. Senator Hart in the Senate, we've worked very closely with, Senator Biden in the Senate, very closely with Senator Biden. He put it in the Senate version of the supplemental. Last week, and of course, the way this process works, the House and the Senate, they go to conference. And can you believe this? In conference, the Republicans took that provision out of the supplemental. Now,
well, this is kind of an old trick now. I mean, they've been doing that a lot over the last couple of years since they've controlled both the House and the Senate. They go, oh, yeah, we'll go along with that out in public. But then when we get in a conference committee where the cameras aren't on, the microphones, we'll just pull that thing back out.
Well, I think that's why it's important to expose, because they have abused their power like it's hard to believe how they've abused their power. Also, this speaks right to the democratic functions of our government. I mean, there is very little democracy left on Capitol Hill. The American people can say one thing, the Bush administration's they pretend, and then they do just the opposite. And I hope people see this for what it is, the abuse of power, they're corrupt. And, in fact, if they can take an amendment, this is important. I mean, this is very important in terms of our young men and women. First of all, the violence is not going to stop until our troops come home. The violence is not going to stop if the Iraqis believe that we're going to be there permanently. And so this is a very important policy to have as part of our foreign and military policy to help reduce the violence now that our young men and women and Iraqis are facing. And, of course, Bush administration once again have done the wrong thing.
So we all said, that is the American people, we don't want permanent bases in Iraq. The Bush administration said, we're not going to put permanent bases in Iraq. You put this into law or into proposed legislation in the House. It goes into conference. The Bushies pull it out, or the Republicans pull it out.
That's what happened.
What's the future of this from this point forward?
We're going to continue to fight. Actually, the supplemental is on the floor tonight, so, of course, I will be involved in the debate. And there are other bills coming forward that I will attempt to amend to put it in once again. So we are not letting this slide. This is just the beginning of the fight. They think we're going to go away. Heavens no. We're going to be there right in their face each and every time on this issue.
You know, we're talking with Representative Barbara Lee of the 9th District of California. It seems to me that whenever we use the phrase war in Iraq, that we're helping them construct the frame that works best for them. Because to leave a war without a clear declaration of victory is a loss. And I think regardless of politics, and probably most Americans are not all that political. I mean, they have a political affiliation, but they're not all that politically wise, let's say. Regardless of politics, nobody wants to lose a war. Why don't we start referring to this, those of us on this side, as the occupation of Iraq? Because really when George Bush came out and said in May of 2003, the war in Iraq is finished, the battle for Baghdad is over, he was right. We had a successful war. We overthrew a sitting government. I mean, you know, what successful militarily anyway. It was morally and ethically wrong. It was the wrong thing. Militarily, it was brilliant, though. I mean, in 3 weeks, we took out a government. So he had his war. It was successful. The war is over. We're 2 years into two and a half years into an occupation right now. I could just imagine, you know, Tim Russert saying, you know, Senator, about the war in Iraq, and somebody saying, well, no, are you talking about the occupation of Iraq? Why don't we start? Because if you withdraw from an occupation, there's no foul, there's no shame, there's no embarrassment. You can't lose an occupation.
I think you're absolutely right. We have to change the frame, and we have to change our language and how we communicate what this is really about. First of all, there was no declaration of war. So how in the world can you have a war when there's no declaration of a war? The Constitution won't allow for that. We bombed the heck out of a country. We took a preemptive military strike based on distortions and lies. That's what we did. We committed an act that was unwarranted, illegal, and immoral. It is an occupation. It is a tremendous loss to the Iraqis and to America, and I think you're right. I think we need to start calling it what it is. It's an occupation, but it has led to a civil war. And so when we talk about,
it's a whole other problem.
You know, war, there's a war going on there, and it's a civil war that the United States of America has helped create.
Yeah, and therefore we have to help clean up. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, the 9th District of California. Congresswoman Lee, thanks for the marvelous service you're doing to your country, for all of us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm very pleased to have you on the air with us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 56 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour, my friends, with more live from the Take Back America Conference right here in Washington, D.C.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back live from Washington, D.C. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from the Take Back America Conference. David Bollier is our guest in this segment. David, here at the conference, his website, bollier.org, and many other affiliated ones. David, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here with us, David. And a lot that we could talk about. Your work with the Commons, really important stuff. A number of, well, just toss out a couple of the URLs of the organizations that you're involved
with. Well, I edit a blog and website called onthecommons.org, and essentially we see that the Commons is a way of describing all these assets that the American people own in common, but may not realize they don't own, and therefore they're not really controlling it. And part of the problem is that the market or corporations are privatizing stuff that belongs to us. The internet, the human genome, national parks, the airwaves that commercial broadcasters use for free. It goes on and on. And so talking about the Commons is a way to start to repossess the stuff that's being dispossessed from us.
And the best site for a discussion, the website for a discussion of the Commons?
Onthecommons.org.
Onthecommons.org. Now, you're also the author of a book, Brand Name Bullies, The Quest to Own and Control Culture. And it's interesting, on this program a couple of weeks ago, I suggested that I thought that our copyright laws were out of control, copyright and trademark laws, that you could argue that, you know, Bill Gates is a multi-billionaire for one reason and one reason only, and that is that the government has enforced ownership of an intellectual property that he originally purchased when he bought the original operating system that became Microsoft, MS-DOS. And did a very good job of marketing. This is not to minimize Bill Gates' efforts and all that sort of thing, but is it appropriate that Microsoft and Disney and all these other companies have copyrights and trademarks that last so long and are enforced so solidly? I mean, I going back and reading Jefferson's letters, he was absolutely opposed to copyright and trademark law, or at the most he thought it should last 2 years.
Because he knew it was a monopoly privilege that the Congress was granting, and that was all subject to all sorts of anti-competitive, anti-consumer abuses. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with people earning money for their investments or hard work. The problem is, in something that's not a real property, something that's intangible like music or text or visual stuff, which now can be replicated for virtually nothing, the public has certain entitlements if culture is going to continue. You can't create culture out of thin air. You have to build on the past. And if the past is all locked up, you can't create anything. And so you're basically held hostage to all these incumbent creators or corporations that have amassed huge inventories of copyrights or trademarks.
Well, let's just do this with me playing devil's advocate here. If you're going to weaken the copyright protection laws, then why should, well, I have 19 books in print, why should I bother writing a book? Or for that matter, you. I mean, David Bollier, you're also an author. Why would people create things? Now, I can answer my own question, but I'll let you do it. Or why would somebody spend, you know, 6 months or a year, pull together 1,000 people and $1 million or multi-million dollars to develop a new game or a new piece of software? How do you get around it?
People who, especially things that require big investments like new drugs or major films or something, people ought to be entitled to earn a fair return on that. The question is, should they be entitled to every conceivable downstream market use of that? Should Ralph Lauren be able to prevent you from using the word polo, which is something that's going on? Should Disney be able to stop any depictions of its characters, even in parody? Should Mattel be able to prevent people from doing mockeries of Barbie dolls, which they've successfully prevented people from doing? So essentially the question is, should we be able to have a free and open democratic culture, or should the commercial ownership rights of major copyright and trademark holders be able to trump that?
But back to the question, what incentive do I have as an entrepreneur who wants to start a business that's going to generate a product which is an intangible, that is an intellectual property, whether it's software or whether it's a piece of literature or whether it's publishing a magazine or whatever, books, whatever it may be? What incentive do I have to do that if the minute my book comes out, it's immediately copied in a million different ways and published on the web and everybody can get it for free and I'm never going to see a nickel from it?
Well, I'm not against copyright or trademark as a legitimate way of protecting certain ownership rights. The point, though, today is that these rights have been extended virtually in perpetuity, and they've prevented the so-called fair use rights of people being able to recycle and reuse previous works. They've closed that down by
As things have gone digital, they've claimed that you can't even take a snippet of something digital. For example, in music, you can't sample anything. So right now, a lot of new creation, a lot of new innovation is being being prevented because of these overexpansions of copyright.
So what is an appropriate period of time for a trademark or copyright protection or monopoly, to use Jefferson's word, to last?
Well, currently, people may not realize, for an individual author, it's their through their lifetime plus 70 years. So these notes they scribbled on this piece of paper are going to be locked up to the year 2200, basically. Now, that's supposedly the incentive, the property incentive I need to create that. Well, of course, that's ludicrous. Yeah. It ought to be an empirical matter. You know, a lot of software programs, the market value of that program is only going to be 2, 3, 5 years. It's not going to be 10, 20, 50 years.
Right.
So let's have some copyright terms that are more realistic for the fair market value of the life of that product.
What's wrong with simply for my lifetime? I mean, that's where it originated, wasn't it?
Well, no, it originated with 14 years. The so-called founder's copyright was 14 years, and later they made it renewable for another 14.
What year was that 14 years established, you know?
That, I believe, 1789, or 1791, when the Constitution was adopted.
Wow. And so 14-year protection, and then the second 14 years was added?
20 or 30 years later.
Which made it 28 years.
And
that lasted until when?
It started really taking off in the 60s and beyond.
The 1960s. So from the founding of this country, for all practical purposes, until the 1960s, you had a copyright for 28 years. And I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think that anybody was out there complaining that they were not going to write the next, you know, Sinclair Lewis didn't say, well, okay, I've made enough money on that book, I'm just going to retire because I can't protect the rest of my books.
Basically, it's profiteering. In the mid-90s, Disney prevailed upon Congress to extend the term of copyrights by 20 years because Mickey Mouse was going to enter the public domain. The net effect of that was to lock up tens of thousands of works from the 1920s and 30s that were about to enter the public domain. And as a result, American culture is greatly impoverished because we don't have access to our own historical cultural legacy.
Amazing. Well, it's a great and important issue. David Bollier is the author of Brand Name Bullies, The Quest to Own and Control Culture. The website, is there a website for the book, David?
Brandnamebullies.com.
Brandnamebullies.com. What a Creative Commons license.
Well, that's an ingenious way to get around this. People who are authors or creators of music, text, films can upfront say, you can use, here's my Creative Commons license that allows you to use it for whatever purpose you want as long as it's non-commercial and I get attribution for it. There's a number of different options people can have. But if people want to use it commercially, then I want permission and perhaps negotiate a payment or a license. So it's the Creative Commons licenses are carving out a middle ground between no control or returns on one's investment at all versus utterly strict lockup of the work.
Now, but the problem is there's ways around that. I, for example, back in the 90s, I owned a company in Atlanta that did seminars. We did training of other companies all around the world, primarily on marketing and communication. And there were three other companies that we were competing with here in the United States that, and this was probably in total, I don't know, a $10 million industry or something. It was a relatively small industry, but, you know, for how to do newsletters, how to do communications, things like that. These three companies were all bought by one nonprofit. Now, we did this all of our marketing by direct mail. So I was paying 17, 18 cents a piece to drop a piece of direct mail, and we'd mail a couple million a year. My competitors were now spending 11 cents a piece because they were now nonprofit. And, you know, we just had to bail out of the business. We couldn't compete because they were nonprofit, which technically is non-commercial. The CEOs of the companies that sold to the nonprofit, you know, got huge bonuses, got huge salaries. I mean, they were making out like band. I mean, how do you get around that kind of thing?
Well, I don't think that's a copyright or trademark issue, but I think that's a matter of market concentration.
No, that's the commercial issue. That what they were arguing before the post office is that they were no longer commercial ventures. They were not-for-profit ventures.
I see. Well,
and yet they were competing in a commercial arena.
That's a very difficult legal question of what's non-commercial or not. Non-profit is, I might add, different from non-commercial.
How?
Well, structurally you're trying to earn a profit, yes, from a corporation.
Right.
Whereas with a non-profit, you're ostensibly serving a public need that the market wouldn't serve. Now,
I'm telling you about the legal theory, not the application.
Right.
And
the application is a little more complicated.
I think the IRS and the application is something that needs to be taken a look at.
David Bullier, the book Brand Name Bullies, brandnamebullies.com.
Yes.
David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Tom Hartman here with you, 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
As a young man, I found politics in the bushes are my door. And I got real good at dirty tricks. My name, sir, is Karl Rove. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me. Cause when your administration's gone, the right will kiss my knee.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Sitting at the table here with me now is Congressman Peter DeFazio of the great state of Oregon. Congressman DeFazio, welcome.
Hey, Tom. Great. Great to be on your show face-to-face for a change.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, yeah, Peter is a regular on our morning show on AM 620 KPOJ. Great to have you with us. I'm curious. I was just showing you this thing about the Bush administration appears to have created a $480 million slush fund for themselves. Now, Reagan did something like this during the Iran-Contra times with money that he got from, some would argue, selling cocaine or smuggling it in, certainly selling weapons to Iran. That was illegal. How is it that Bush is doing this legally? Any sense of this?
Well, I think it's, you know, the new world. We have the inherent powers of the presidency as defined by Attorney General Gonzales, which are in a time of, quote, war, even though there's no declared war. The Constitution, Bill of Rights, none of that exists. And there's only one branch of government, which is the executive branch of the presidency. Yeah. So, but, you know, maybe, you know, the Republicans have allowed, you know, the wiretapping. They, you know, they allow trampling on, you know, our right to declare war, and I mean a whole host of things they've let go by. They finally created some stir over the search of Representative Jefferson's office. Maybe, just maybe, you know, we can stir things up on this and they'll challenge the president. I'm not sure whether they've got the guts to do that, but we'll see. I mean, this is clearly an outrageous, you know, preemption of, you know, the Congress. I mean, I understand quite a good deal about this, the dispute having particularly involved the Pacific Northwest, and no one in all the many conversations that I've had over the last decade over what would happen to this money has ever said, oh, well, the president could just take part of it and do what he wants with it. I mean, there's nobody who said that. Maybe all the Republicans in the timber industry who just love George Bush, even though he hasn't done anything for him,
right,
will be a little outraged about this, too.
What's amazing to me is $480 million is, I think, within $5 million or so of how much Rupert Murdoch lost starting Fox News. You could literally start, that was a five-year budget, right? You could literally start Fox News for with the amount of money that George W. Bush now is claiming as a slush fund for the White House. I mean, imagine what we could do with that.
Half a billion dollars.
That's real money.
That's almost as much money as we're borrowing in 8 hours to run the country.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, which is a startling number. Most people don't know. We're borrowing about $1.4 billion a day to run the United States under Bush's budgetary priorities and policies, and particularly his tax policies, where we finance tax cuts by borrowing money to give rich people money.
Right, and then call them tax cuts, ignoring the fact that eventually it's going to have to be paid, which means that it's going to be taxes. It's actually a tax increase because our children and grandchildren are going to have to pay it plus interest.
Right, it's a tax on future generations, is right. What it is. You know, we've talked about something called a birth tax now, because they talk about death tax. Well, it's a birth tax. Every baby coming into the world today is inheriting $28,000 of debt, and it'll be a lot more by the time they're old enough to go to work at age 16 or so.
Sure. Yeah. Well, maybe we'll just lower the age to 13.
Yeah, they can get going earlier. Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't want them to die not having paid off their debt. I mean, rich people shouldn't have to pay taxes, but babies, you know, should pay off their debt.
And we don't need no public education. You know, by then we'll have defunded the schools, and, you know, the new world order will be here, the conservative world. Cynicism aside, speaking of borrowing, you mentioned before we got on the air here that some new, was it new numbers on the trade deficit or just?
Yeah, it's last Friday. It's the monthly announcement. It was only the fifth largest month in history, of course. All five of them have occurred since 2005. And, you know, we're on a trend to hit about $770 billion this year. That's more than $2 billion a day borrowed from overseas.
Just so that we can buy stuff. This is not to run the government. This is so we can buy stuff from Walmart.
We're borrowing $1.4 billion a day to run the government, and then we're borrowing $2 billion a day to buy stuff made overseas that used to be made in America by people who earned a decent living. It's now being made by Chinese working virtually as slave labor. China's becoming the fastest owner or accumulating U.S. debt more quickly than anybody else. That has some interesting implications for the future. But the other thing that was really notable in this is more than a third of it was just due to oil imports. I mean, here we are. And just think back. I mean, the government of Brazil 30 years ago said, oh, this is untenable for a major and growing power like Brazil to be in debt to OPEC and at their mercy and all that. We're going to become energy self-sufficient. Well, they did. 30 years. Took them 30 years. And George Bush has a plan to have us actually importing more oil 10 years from today than we do now. Now, that's a really great plan for the American consumers, for national security.
It's a great plan for Lee Raymond.
Raymond
pension retirement.
If you're going to pay the CEOs of the oil companies $400 or $500 million pensions, you know, we got to get that money somewhere.
So. Yeah.
$100 million a day last year, ExxonMobil profit. $100 million a day.
In profit.
Yeah. Not bad.
Wow, nice work if you can get it.
Yeah. So, I mean, they only gave their CEO 4 days' profits.
When are you guys in Congress going to start breaking up these monopolies in 5 seconds or less?
Well, that's part of my bill. I have a comprehensive bill on energy independence, energy future, and one of the things is to break up the monopolies.
When the Democrats take over.
Yeah.
That's the short answer.
Congressman, coming up with these folks, I'll tell you that.
Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon, we're broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hurt.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Bilen Mendoza is with us. I mispronounced it.
A little bit. Not too much.
Go for it.
It's Bilen Mendoza.
Bilen.
Bilen.
Bilen Mendoza. And Bilen Mendoza is with, she's the outreach director, political outreach director for AmericaVotes.org. AmericaVotes.org, the website. America Votes is the largest grassroots voter mobilization and education effort in America today.
It is. We are proud. We've been around since 2003, so it's not a new organization. And we're hoping that, you know, we'll take America.
How?
We are a group that organizes around the choice community, the unions, and all the progressive organizations. We came together to build like a progressive table, an infrastructure where we work together. We create coordinated campaigns in states, so we reach out to every person, and we don't double reach to people. So we maximize the resources and make sure that everyone gets touched at least once.
So, Bilen Mendoza.
Yeah. We'll go with that.
No.
Bilen.
Bilen.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's a new name to me.
It's a Spanish name, obviously. Yeah. I'm from Argentina, and it's Bethlehem in English.
Ah, interesting. Bilen Mendoza, and with AmericaVotes.org, the organization. We, on the way into this segment, the kind of cutesy music that you heard was Diebold, Diebold, right? The voting machine.
Right.
How do we deal with this? What... Are any of the organizations out there that are engaged in voter outreach, that are trying to register voters, also taking up the issue of the fact that, essentially starting with the Reagan administration, you know, it slowly began in the 1980s, that our votes have been privatized? What do we do about that?
Well, that's what we're trying to do. We, you know, the reason why America Votes came together was because we wanted to reach out to the voters that were disenfranchised, that they were not being reached out, that they were not voting because they were afraid that their vote was not going to count. So we came together, and what we're trying to do is build a coalition that will educate people and make sure that their vote does count, and if it doesn't, that we, you know, we address the problem. Every election year we have hotlines that work with this. For example, we work very closely with LULAC, which is a Hispanic league that works with Hispanic citizens, and so they have also a hotline that reach out and that people can call in if they have problems. So this is being addressed as we speak, just because we understand as a progressive movement that a lot of people don't come out and vote based on 2000 because they feel disenfranchised. They feel that they're not being reached out to.
And yet if the machine doesn't count their vote, what do you do?
Well, I think every state is dealing with that depending on the state. I know Florida has an initiative on the ballot to make sure that they have ballot initiatives and machines initiative. And I think that they're addressing it state by state. And we're working in the states we're in to address that issue.
Yeah. How?
Working with the Secretary of State and making sure that this is being done.
It just seems like there needs to be a grassroots effort in the United States to say privatization of the vote is wrong.
Right.
That, you know, if the government wants to privatize the hot dog stand in Yellowstone, which used to be run by government employees, and they want to have, you know, Burger King run that, you know, I'm opposed to it because it's government property and it shouldn't be privatized, but I'll let them get away with it. But if they're going to privatize my vote,
right,
that's a crime. And nobody is framing it that way. I just don't hear it being talked about that way. Well, let's move along. What in order, we also saw just now, have you read Robert Kennedy's piece in Rolling Stone about what happened in Ohio? Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he wrote a piece about the theft of the Ohio vote in 2004. It lays out the ways that Ken Blackwell and the Republicans in Ohio removed 350,000 people from the rolls, people who were registered, who thought they were registered, and prevented a lot of the registrations, the new registrations,
right,
from ever getting entered into the system. How do you deal with that? This has to do with registration, which is what you're all about. Right?
We actually don't do voter registration.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Oh, okay. Then recalibrate for me. I'm sorry.
Okay. What we do is we come together and we create coordinated campaigns. We do voter mobilization, education, and get out the vote.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do voter registration. At least none of our states are doing that right now.
Are you doing this in a partisan fashion or a nonpartisan fashion?
Nonpartisan fashion. We are a 527, so we don't do talk about candidates or campaign or parties.
Right.
So we talk about moving to get forward progressive agenda.
Now there are a lot of churches, for example, in the United States, particularly the mega churches, who say essentially the same thing, that they're entirely nonpartisan, and yet they know that all the people that they're calling are Republicans because they happen to be their constituents and they're the folks who are going to those churches and they're preaching Republican, you know, George Bush is a great man sort of thing. Is the constituency that you're serving one that tends to be more Democratic-leaning and thus would put you perhaps at risk of attacks by the Republican Party down the road on, you know...
Not necessarily. I mean, the people that we reach out to is the people that our coalitions reach out to. America Votes, per se, doesn't have members that belong to America Votes. The members are the members of our partner organizations, such as the Sierra Club, the League of Conservation Voters, SEIU, ASME, the AFL. So we work together with these groups that are on the ground already creating coordinated campaigns to mobilize people and create programs. What America Votes essentially does is create a table in each state that will, you know, bring everyone together who is progressive doing work and kind of figure out what areas, who is working with, what message everyone is using to create a more of a unified message and create a bigger mobilization and reaching out to more areas.
Belen?
Belen.
Mendoza. AmericaVotes.org, the website. the political outreach director. Thanks so much for being
with
us today. Great talking with you. It's 21 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Strangers on the right, invading Congress. Strangers on the right, impeding progress. They'll put up a fight. Two liberals like you. Something in their eyes resembles fire. Roe v. Wade's demise is their desire. Cutting down to size those states that still are blue. Strangers on the right, to Europeans they are strangers on the right. Not seen in eons, they will terrorize the left. Leave their hopes bereft, making no nest yesterday and taking welfare grants away. Democrats, you are.
Welcome back, my friend. 47 minutes before the hour. That's the first time I've heard that bumper music. It's great. We have with us Kara. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. And we have Kara Nussbaum with us. She's the executive director of Working America, as well as the special assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO. Karen, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you here with us. Working America. Explain to our listeners what Working America is.
Working America is the best-kept secret in the progressive movement. Just started a couple of years ago. We're a community affiliate of the AFL-CIO for people who don't have a union on the job. So for those workers who are cut out of the getting a union on the job because their boss is too bad or the laws are too awful, we go door-to-door in communities around the country and talk to them about issues and sign them up. And so far, we've got more than a million members who are grateful to have a way to speak out on these issues.
That's great. Now, if I am a union member, I'm a member after, but if I was not a union member and I wanted to join, for that matter, union members could join, can't they? Or not?
Well, we're not looking to sign up union members because they already have a strong organization
right.
representing them, and so we're.
But
really
you have open membership.
Sure. Yeah. No one's going to get after you
okay.
if you sign up.
So if I want to join Working America, what do I do?
You can just go to our website at workingamerica.org, and it's real simple to sign up. Dues are voluntary. What we're really looking for is people who want to fight back for good jobs and a just economy.
Well said. And how much are the voluntary dues?
$5 a year.
$5 a year?
What a bargain.
Man.
Tom, how can you walk away from this?
I could trade that in for AFTRA.
But you wouldn't get the power on the job. But we have an... We go around in communities, and two out of three people we talk to in the suburbs and the exurbs, we're talking about working class, moderates and conservatives, the folks who have not had a good reason to vote for anything except those wedge issues that the Republicans keep dishing out to them, until we come to their neighborhoods and say, look, we can band together to win health care. We can band together to raise the minimum wage or to keep good jobs in this country. And that's what working people are looking for. And we're able to do this on a scale that is really big and can be extremely powerful.
That actually works. We're talking with Kara Nussbaum. She's the executive director of Working America. Working America, are you taking on specific issues, or is this just about building constituency? And I'm assuming labor issues, but...
Right. We focus on issues having to do with good jobs, and our members vote the priority issues for us every 6 months. And in the last 6 months, their number one issue was health care, and it is a huge issue. And so that's why we're working with the AFL-CIO to win fair share health care legislation in 30 states around the country. And that would require big companies who don't have most of their members, their employees in healthcare to pay into a public fund.
Mm-hmm.
We're working on that. We're working on a minimum wage to get it on the ballot in Ohio. We just, in Pennsylvania, delivered 1,100 handwritten letters demanding that the state raise the minimum wage in Pennsylvania just a few days ago.
Yeah.
So we're finding that we're able to get our members active. They write letters to their legislators. They send email messages. They are now beginning to call and walk their own neighborhoods. It's very exciting.
Karen Nussbaum, the executive director of Working America. Karen, I'm guessing that what is being billed by the Republicans as illegal immigration is going to be probably the main wedge issue in the 2006 elections. Everything I'm hearing from people I know who are involved in Republican strategy stuff, they're looking at, for example, this recent race in California where Francine Busby made the unfortunate choice of words of you can vote without papers, you don't need papers to vote. What she meant to say and what she corrected herself immediately was you don't need papers to volunteer to work on a campaign. But in any case, we have this issue, and prior to 2000, I think it was 2000, prior to the year 2000, the position of most labor unions was that it's a good and important thing to have and enforce immigration law. And since 2000, it seems like many of the unions have flipped on that and have said, let's provide amnesty, for lack of a better word. And I'm just curious if, number one, Working America has taken a position on this, and number two, if so, if it's going to be a decision made democratically by your members, or is it going to come from the top down?
Well, we don't have an independent position on Working America on immigration in particular, but the AFL-CIO does have a position, which I think is the right one, and it says that every worker deserves to have full rights, and that you can't have workers who have less than full rights, because then nobody has full rights. And so we do favor all workers having full rights, amnesty for workers who are in this country, and not allowing bracero programs, which we think have never worked well. So so it's a, and we think this will be an issue already that we know is a lightning rod, and that's why for us the most important thing is, first of all, make sure that we have plenty of information, and we do. We provide information to our members on what's at stake, but also to focus on the issues that are more immediate, that unify working people, and certainly health care is one of those, minimum wage, keeping good jobs in this country, and that's what we need to keep forward. Let's not focus on the wedge issues. Let's focus on the ones that we have unity around.
Well, I agree. I'm just, my concern, and it's a very real concern, is that this is going to be the issue of the 2006 elections, and that the Democrats have been set up on this thing. And You go out and you talk to folks, working people in America, and most of them are actually opposed to amnesty, or at least, you know, the polls that I'm seeing and the, you know, people who call into this program, as a progressive talk radio program, and the history of the labor movement has been to limit the availability of labor, because if you limit the availability of labor, you increase its price, which is a desirable thing. That's how middle classes emerge. So the labor movement, and, you know, Mother Jones in the 1880s and 1890s was out there saying no child labor. Why? Well, you know, it's not good for kids, but the main reason was because they're competing with us adults. And I think a lot of Americans are of the opinion that, you know, yes, building a fence is stupid. Putting somebody in jail because they helped out somebody who's here and not a citizen is stupid. We don't really need either of those things. And that we don't have an illegal immigration problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem. We have corporations who are moving hundreds of millions of dollars in profits to the bottom of the line by using people who are not citizens, who will work for less than people who are citizens. Why doesn't labor just own up to that? I mean, that was the position of labor in 1995.
But I think that actually we do believe that the way you solve this problem is that you give all workers equal rights.
Oh, I agree with that. But if you give 20 million people amnesty, you've just increased the labor pool in the United States by 20 million. How then can you expect the cost of labor to go up?
Well, you know, I think that there's more than enough profit to go around, and the problem doesn't have to do with too many workers. It has to do with too little power, that the unions don't have the kind of, working people don't have the kind of power that they did 40 years ago to demand a more equal distribution of the profit. There's plenty of profit. There's plenty of money.
So if I'm understanding this right, then your belief or strategy is that if you can legalize or bring illegal aliens or whatever you want, undocumented workers, if you can make them citizens and make them lawful, that they will be more likely to join a union, and that will increase union membership to the point where unions will then again have the power to enforce higher wages?
Well, I'm not sure it's a strategy. I think that what we believe is that in order for any worker to have rights, everybody has to have rights, or else employers find the easy way out. And that what we need to do now is rebuild a workers' movement that can really contend with corporate power, which has totally distorted the economy. It's a very robust economy. There's plenty of money to go around. It's just only swirling around at the top. And that's why we built Working America.
But the only thing workers have to demand higher wages is withholding their labor. That's the only thing workers have.
Oh, no, that's not true. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that the corporate agenda takes power away from workers.
Oh, sure.
You do it through privatization, you do it through
corporations have 100 ways to do it, but all we can do is say, I'm not going to work, I'm going on strike.
That's not true. You can fight on politics. I mean, the way they...
Oh, you can organize. Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. You're right. Karen Nussbaum, Executive Director of Working America, Special Assistant to the President of the AFL-CIO, the website workingamerica.org.
And become a member today.
Visit, join it. There you go. Okay. Become a member today. Great organization. Karen Nussbaum, thanks for being with us.
Great, thank you.
It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. We'll see you again tomorrow, friends.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.